Good morning, everybody.
Anyway, less seniority than me.
The House State Affairs Committee will come to order at about 4 minutes after eight. And welcome, everybody. So far in the committee, we have with us Representative Johnson, Representative Johansson, Representative Vice Chair Bob Rogers, myself, Representative Bob Lynn, and it's in that a couple more are en route. So again, welcome this morning.
Okay.
And this morning we have four bills to consider. I'll get a short report from Reverend Johansson on the subcommittee that we had given him the honor of heading here. And so we're going to hear an order, HB 353, Public Library Internet Filters, HB 261, Publicly Financed Elections, HB 266, State Employee Defendants, Child Care, and HB 366, Disclosure on Appropriation from the Permanent Fund. So with that, we'd ask Reverend Keller to come forward for HB 353. Good morning, sir.
For the record, Wes Keller, sponsor of HB 353, representing District 14. I would again ask your consideration and decision on this bill. The bill envisions a scenario where pornography is dangerous to little children, and it asks our public libraries to step in line with the Children's Internet Protection Act and filter their internet access computers. And I won't really walk you through the whole thing. I know you're all familiar with the bill we've presented before, and there's been testimony on it. But I would like to call your attention. I think you've been given a overview of 353 and how it affects the what's affected by the Department of Administration.
And if I might break in, just for the committee and the vast audience we have here, we are working on version M, and that's already been adopted, and public testimony has, in fact, been closed. And I'd like to point out that Reverend Coghill has now joined our illustrious committee. Go ahead, Wes.
If I might, I just want to read the last comment by Department of Administration, which is consistent with what I intended with the bill. And it gave me some encouragement, if that's okay. Just one short paragraph. HB 353 contemplates securing independent internet connectivity in libraries throughout the state. With such independent connections, an endpoint home solution such as NetNanny, Norton, Internet Security, or Webmaster for $60 to $100 per station would accomplish the goals sought in 353. I'll stop right there. But again, I just want to emphasize the point that the bill does not get into the standard of the filtering. It presumes that the librarians care about our kids. And it just says, hey, you know, get a filter on there. You know, and then they can go out there, and many are watching it. They're right there, you know, and they wouldn't think of letting children come in and watch pornography if they happen to catch it. This is just a little safeguard. It is inexpensive, and I would ask to pass the bill.
It's my understanding with these filters that you can take a filter and you can put any degree of protection in that filter that the person who's, would want to. I guess it's probably a password, so you can't. The regular person can't change the filter.
Representative Lynn, my understanding is that it's about as complex as you want it to be. In other words, it's if you really want to get into this, you can make it pretty exotic. But like I say, it's available at Walmart. People with medium computer skills can go in there and turn it on and off and use that, whatever level. It's only as good as a person installing it, or it's only at the level at the person that chooses.
Well, they're installing it, and what level they put the protection. I know, like I have a spam filter, and I could run it very high or very low depending on what I want. So the individual supervisor at the library, I guess, would be the one to decide to set that filter where it filters everything almost. Or filter almost nothing, but the purpose of this bill would be to have a filter and then leave the terminate exactly where to put the level of the filtration up to the person administering the program. And these are typically pretty inexpensive filters.
Precisely.
Okay. And if you'll, the committee will remember, I believe I had an amendment that changed that we took out the university system because we're presuming that everybody's old enough to go to the university, they are are, if not chronologically, at least intellectually and an adult, and would make their own decisions. And this only would apply to the school and other public libraries, but not the university system. Is that correct?
That's, as I understand it, yes, sir.
Okay. I'd like to point out Reverend Dahl has joined us. Good morning, ma'am. Any questions for Reverend Keller? Okay. I would like to move this bill and see what the pleasure of the committee is.
I do have a question.
Yes. By the way, I see Steve Rollins, my constituent, if he hadn't deserted my district yet, from the University of Alaska, is available for questions or not. Testimony, and Representative Grunberg has not joined us.
Thank you. We had some discussion, and we had comments by several different libraries, one being the Juneau Library, that this isn't an issue for them because the computers that are made available to children are in a separate section of the library and it's close by the station where they're constantly being monitored. And so at some point in time, we were talking about the possibility of having an amendment that dealt with blocking or monitoring so that we weren't hampering those libraries that were already had put situations in place where they were closely monitoring any of the equipment that this information could be accessed through. And then we also heard testimony from a small library, I believe it was up in Tok, if I'm not mistaken.
Tok and Gullah Junction, one of the
others.
But they were quite concerned that, you know, having to go through this process would either shut their library down, but they also stated that their computers are positioned in such a way that they constantly monitor them to make sure that that type of behavior doesn't occur. And so, absent an amendment that would allow that type of situation to be in place, I will have difficulty supporting this bill. So, at some point in time, we had an amendment that was written up. I don't know who provided it. But it's still in my packet. It was Amendment M1.
That was from a constituent that had requested it, and so we had one drafted up for that reason.
Okay. That's probably the two ladies from Tolkien.
Would this conversation not being recorded, could you share what it is?
I didn't remember who had the amendment, it was a recommendation that was sent in by somebody online. And I don't know if everybody has in their packet or not, but it would be listed as Amendment M1. Please.
Do you want to add ease for a second?
No. I can go ahead and talk to the amendment. First of all, I'll move Amendment Number 1.
Object so that we can hear it.
And would you please tell us what the amendment is?
Yes. What the amendment does is it also, everywhere it says blocking of certain Internet sites, it will say blocking or monitoring. And where it says filters, it will say filters or monitoring. And then it specifically describes that you can use an alternate monitoring system to prevent the viewing of Internet sites that depict the items described in this section. Then it talks about the different technology that Representative Keller already mentioned. And then it also goes further on to identify that alternate monitoring system means a monitoring system that does not use Internet software filters, but could include the ability for the staff to view the screens of the computers when they're used by the public, so that this would prevent access, or if they did gain access, certainly they could be removed from the computer within a short amount of time. So, again, I understand the concept of the bill. I support the idea of the bill. It's just the implementation of it that gives me great concern. And I think in terms of the Juneau Public Library, we heard plenty of testimony from them already saying that they have this system in place. And so if they're already doing the job, we shouldn't necessarily, in my opinion, go in and cause them any unnecessary changes to what they already have if it's working. This is not, you know, it's the old adage that your mom gave you, if it's not broke, don't fix it.
I used that on another subject, actually.
That too.
Yesterday. Representative Dahl.
Thank you. I would support that amendment, but I guess I'm wondering if we support the amendment, what I don't know what the purpose of the bill is then.
My thought.
I don't support the bill, and I support the amendment. So I'm not sure where we want to go with this, because as I say, if I think we take this amendment, then there's no point to the bill.
If I may respond.
Roses?
And that was my first reaction, too, when I read the amendment, that it just basically guts the bill. And
you're on the amendment, you thought that.
I'm on the amendment. And so when I read the amendment the first time, my reaction was exactly the same. Just kill the bill, because this virtually does the same thing. But then I got to thinking about it, and it doesn't. And I went back to the testimony of the Juneau librarian. They have computers that are set up in two separate sections. There's those that the adults use, and there's those that the kids use. It's no different than turning a filter on or turning a filter off. You have a section where the adults use the computers. You have a section where the children use the computers, and the children aren't allowed in the adult section for the computers where this would occur. This would allow the libraries, without a tremendous amount of additional expense, to relocate the computers or put a couple of computers by a desk that were accessible by the children, and the other computers in the library would be accessible by adults. It allows them that as an option, or they can purchase the filter system. Either one, but we give them a choice. And so I don't see where it necessarily eliminates that from the bill. The technology is still available. If they don't want to reconfigure the library and move the computers where they can be monitored, or they don't have the staff to monitor them, then purchase the filters.
Do they not, Reverend, already have the choice? I mean, there's no law that I'm aware of that says library may not have a filter. So, I mean, they already have that choice.
Mr. Chair, I wouldn't disagree with you on that, but we haven't passed a law that said they had to filter them at this point. So a choice wasn't an issue. If nobody's told you or mandated in regulation that you're going to lose funding if you don't do it, they exercised the choice before because it was prudent for them to do so. We're now telling everybody you will do it or you're going to run the risk of losing your funding. So now at least we're giving them an option how they could comply with the law that we're trying to put upon them that doesn't currently exist.
If you know the comment, I'm going to ask the sponsor for his comments on it, and then we'll either move the objection or take a vote, one or the other.
Thank you, Chair Lynn. I really agree with Representative Dahl that if you do this, it kills the bill. There's no definition of monitoring. It doesn't not kill a bill, but there's just nothing there that is required, and it's just a waste of time. So I would speak against the amendment, and if the committee chooses to pass it, I would have less enthusiasm for the bill by a very great degree.
My own thought is that this effectively kills the bill by amendment.
Mr. Chair, may I respond?
Euthanizes it. Yes.
The amendment does define what monitoring is. It's very specific. An alternate monitoring system means a monitoring system that does not use internet software filters, includes a method that enables the public library staff to see the screens of the computers in the public library.
Okay.
So it's direct visual access to the computer screen.
Okay, any other,
so it is defined.
Any other comment from anybody else on the committee on this amendment? Do you maintain your objection?
Mr. Chairman, let me speak to it first.
Yes, please.
It does, in the amendment, describe why we have the alternate monitoring system, and that is to prevent the viewing of Internet sites depicted in the section 1161A through F. So the purpose is either to filter or to monitor. And the cost of monitoring has been already picked up by some, I think.
Already picked up by whom?
Already picked up by some as far as staffing goes, or the way they arrange the library. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to remove my objection. I'm going to let it go. I'll go ahead and vote for it because I think the purpose, if I understand the sponsor's purpose, is to prevent the viewing of this pornography described in 1161-128. And whether or not a filtering system can actually do that or not, I suppose, depends on how much money they're willing to put into it. But if they're willing to put staff time in and prevent that, then I think when you go to grants, they're going to ask, well, what is your prevention scheme? And so with that, I'm going to remove my objection to the amendment.
Okay, any other?
Much to the chagrin of my friend, the sponsor of this bill.
Are there any yes.
I'm going to maintain an objection, Mr. Chair, for the following reasons. Number one, this could cause a lot of litigation between, or real controversy between the state on the one hand and little libraries on the other, who are going to be faced with a large loss of revenue. And Ms. Berg gave us some figures here that, for example, in Chiniac, with a population of 52, their total operating revenue is $6,350, and the amount of state grants is $6,250. They will have to shut down if somebody finds that they're not totally monitoring this stuff. The second reason is because this legislation is tied into the criminal code that we've talked about before, and at least potentially this could render librarians and their staff liable as accessories, at least, to a felony. And I find this is a very draconian solution. There's no funding protection for this, and they may not have to buy the blocking stuff here, but they're going to have to take staff time, and there's not a dime put into this. So I will maintain my objection to this and the bill.
Okay, no other comments on amendment? That is amendment number one, is that correct? Okay, so would you call the roll, please, on amendment number one?
Representative Johansson.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Gruenberg.
No.
Representative Dahl.
Yes.
Representative Roses.
Yes.
Representative Coghill.
Yes.
Chair Lynn.
No.
5 yea, 2 nay.
So with that, amendment number one has passed. If there any other no further comment, I would accept a motion to move the bill.
I object to moving the bill.
Okay. So an objection? Any?
Mr. Chair,
yes, please.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
There has to be a motion made first before the objection can go.
Well, she's very anxious.
Yes.
With that, Mr. Chairman, I would move that we move CS for House Bill 353, State Affairs, as amended, out of committee with individual recommendations and the attached, if there's any fiscal notes.
Are there any objections?
I object.
Okay. Any objection? Any comment on the objection? We probably talked this to death, but go ahead.
Right. I object to this because I see this as state intruding more into the businesses of municipalities and individuals. I simply oppose this intrusion, and even though we have softened this a great deal, and I thank Representative Roses for doing this, still it is that there's a principle behind this which I object to, and therefore I cannot support the bill.
Okay. Any further comment,
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Coghill.
Two things. First of all, I don't think we soften this bill at all. I think we're going to require, before they can get a grant, a system of monitoring to prevent this pornography. And the other, and the other thing that needs to be put on the record is, even though you reference a criminal code for the description of the pornography, this is just based on granting. And so I don't anticipate there would be any criminal code issues. So just to have that debate with my good friend to the right here.
Okay. And just briefly, please, we have some of the bills.
Well,
no amendments, right? Okay.
That's a good idea, Bob.
AS 1161-128 on electronic distribution of indecent material to minors could render librarians and their staff liable to criminal prosecution. I don't think you can just wink at that statute.
Okay, would you take the roll, please? And this is to up or down on the bill itself, as amended.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Gruenberg.
No.
Representative Dahl.
No.
Representative Roses.
Yes.
Representative Coghill.
Yes.
Representative Johansson.
No.
Chair Lynn.
Yes.
4 yea, 3 nay.
Okay, with that, HB 353 passes from this committee to the next committee. This for what's the next destination of this bill?
Chairman, it goes to the Finance Committee.
Finance Committee.
And I would like to say just again, sincere thanks to all of you for your consideration of the bill. And I learned in the process and appreciate it.
Thank you very much. And day at ease while we sign the paper. Back to order. We have two folks online, but they're here for questions only. And so I would, without objection, I would close public testimony on HB 261. Okay, public testimony is closed. Do you have any follow-on comments that you'd like to make? I was not here for the major debate on this bill, but you know, I followed it fairly closely. Do you have any closing comments before we?
No, Mr. Chair, I believe the committee heard quite a bit of testimony over the weekend, and I think they would like to discuss it themselves.
She needs to identify herself.
For the record, Chairman Lynn, this is Suzanne Hancock, staff to Representative Ledoux.
Yes, and has Representative Dahl been here for any, excuse me, you are here. Has Representative Ledoux been here for any of this testimony? Has she given any testimony before the committee?
For the record, sir, the first meeting she was here.
And then for the detailed debate we had the other day when I was not here, I asked her because I wasn't here, did she give any follow-on testimony or any detailed testimony to refute some of the discussion we had from the committee?
Sir, we went over it, and she is aware of the discussion and the questions.
But she wasn't here to respond directly. No. Fine. Thank you very much. Any further discussion from the committee? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was sort of lukewarm on this bill until about 3 days ago, when a special interest group began running an ad with my name in it in Anchorage that says that I am part of a corrupt legislature, mentions me by name, because of a bill that I voted no recommendation to pass out of a committee. I'm a co-sponsor of the bill. I sat on the committee where it was at, and this public interest group out of Virginia is spending quite a bit of money, defaming all of us, quite honestly. I think we've all seen the ads where they say it's a corrupt legislature and we're taking away your right to vote. Well, they name my name. It's running quite heavily in Anchorage, and there's not a lot I can do about it. And if when it comes election time, if I don't have the ability to fight off that very well-funded extreme environmental group, and I'm dependent on public funds, and for every dollar that I raise, someone else is able to raise to attack me. And if they're attacking me for a vote I haven't made, imagine what they're going to do for the votes I have made. it just so happens in my district that extreme environmentalist groups aren't very well received, so I'm not sure it's not serving as a positive. But I think it goes to show what can happen when third-party expenditures can be made, and this bill does nothing to address them. I mentioned it early on that I thought it would be a problem. It just became a problem much earlier than I'd anticipated. Each and every one of us, every day on TV, all across the state, are being accused of being corrupt by a group out of Virginia that, as near as I can see, hasn't registered with APOC, hasn't filed any paperwork. There's no way to trace where the money comes from. And where my opposition to this bill was slight before, it has now become vehement. I need the ability, and the people that support my points of views need the ability to assist me in fighting this outside attack. And I don't see any other way we can do it with public funds. And unless this bill takes a serious turn and either eliminates third-party expenditures or seriously curtails third-party expenditures, there's no way I can even support it, and I'm tired of hearing about it from this point forward.
I've seen that same ad, and just for information of anybody who's listening in or in the audience, that bill refers to the so-called aerial wolf hunting issue, which, you know, where, whatever your position is on that particular issue, that has nothing whatsoever to do with any of the recent scandals and indictment convictions that we've suffered through with the legislature. Absolutely nothing to do with those other issues at all. Representative Roses?
I think I wanted to speak to the issue that Representative Johnson just brought up, because the bill does address it. And quite frankly, the way it addresses it is even scarier than the process. If an independent expenditure occurs in a campaign and you feel as the candidate and you are participating in the clean elections process that you have been wronged, you have the ability to appeal to the administrator of the clean elections process and require them within 2 days to determine whether or not you have been wronged by this third-party expenditure. If indeed the determination is that you have been, then they have to match whatever amount of money was spent to attack you or to support the candidate running against you up to 3 times the allowable of expenditure for the year. Well, what is an allowable expenditure for the year? In the primary, it's $17,600. So 3 times that would be $52,800 that could be matched to you as a candidate if you participate in the clean elections process, because third-party candidates or PACs are working against you or for the candidate that is opposing you. That's for the primary. In the general, it's 3 times $26,400, which is $79,200. So is this state ready, and are the citizens of this state ready to put their permanent fund dividends at risk to fund political campaigns? Because I can tell you right now, if you take $79,200 and $52,800, the way my math adds up, that's over $130,000. If we have 50 candidates running potentially every year, what's the limit? I mean, where does this go? And I can tell you right now that if I were part of the clean elections process, I've seen that ad is referring to. I sit on that committee as well. And it doesn't specify the committee. It doesn't name me. I'm not named in it. I could just as easily been. I passed the same bill out of committee as Representative Johnson did. But to stay it on there that this entire legislature is corrupt, I can assure you I would go to the administrator and say, I have been wronged by this ad. I need to defend myself. This is an expenditure that qualifies. I need the matching funds. The other part that this doesn't address, what stops political action committees, and I'll just use a labor organization. I used to be president of one, so I know how well we organize things. This doesn't address anything about in-kind. If I get 50 people out of the union that I represented to go out and go door-to-door for me and distribute flyers, this doesn't show up as an expenditure because in-kind contribution of that type doesn't show up. But how does the clean elections process deal with that? I mean, there are many, many, many issues in here. And I can tell you right now that I have, this is only one of the booklets I have, and this is all of the information that I intend to try to get on the record at some point if this thing continues to move forward. I've already, as part of the testimony, read some of this into the record in terms of 3 different surveys that have been done to refute the fact that what the objective of this bill is indeed does not work in these other states where they've tried it. We even have states that tried to pass it and they've repealed it. We have other states that passed it, they put the funding out there and then withdrew the funding. So it's still on the books, they just don't fund it. In essence, it's dead. California tried to pass Proposition 89. Which was the clean elections. It failed by a vote of 25 to 75. 75% of the people didn't think it would work. So I think we're taking something that is an extremely serious issue that has the potential to be very costly to the state. It has the potential to totally revamp the way our election system works in this state. And we want to pass it out of committee without having much thorough discussion on it. I think we ought to all be looking at every one of these reports and determining whether or not we think this information is appropriate, whether or not we think this has any bearing on it, and whether or not we want to make amendments to this bill. And so if the will of the chair is to move this out of committee, then take the vote, but I'm a no. But I think there's some things in this bill that are good. I think there's some things in this bill that are workable to try to reestablish some confidence of the public in the process. I don't think this bill does it. I think it unravels the whole process, and I do not think this bill will accomplish the objective that it states. With that being said, Mr. Chair, I will stop right there, but I think we're just a little hasty. But
the only comment I'd make is that we did amend this bill, I think rightfully so, to take out the word clean election, because this is not really, you put clean, the so-called clean election thing, it makes it sound like you are opposed to it for whatever reason, that you are in favor of dirty elections. I thought that was very inappropriate. So there has been amended out. So the title of this bill is now Public Funding of Elections, which is a more accurate title. Whether you agree with the bill or don't agree with the bill, it's a more fair, more accurate title. Representative Johansson. So please don't use the word clean elections anymore. That's what the initiative is talking about, which I don't want to discuss here. So use it with that, if you will, but please don't use it with this bill. Representative Johansson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With all due respect to the member to my left, a rose by any other name is still a rose.
Yes, it is.
I'll think of a comment later.
And oh, so sweet as well, Mr. Johansson.
Thank you. At my house, when it gets to be 8 o'clock, it's bedtime for my kids. 7:30, they get their pajamas on. 8 o'clock, they're in bed. And it's about 7:57. As far as I'm concerned with this bill, I'd like to put it to bed and let it sleep for Rip Van Winkle sort of a sleep. So I'll be against moving the bill. Thank you.
Okay. Any other comment? Representative Dahl?
I appreciate everything that has been said, and certainly Representative Rose, I think, had an excellent insight into this. I think it's a complicated bill. However, I do think that it needs venting, and as we know, it's an initiative, but I feel that it should get to the floor. I think that we should look at it carefully and consider it and bring it to the floor, and not wait for it to come as an initiative in the fall. Which it will anyway, but I would like to give it the respect and so forth. So I think it's a good start. I actually laud the people that have put their time and work into this, because I think their intent is good, even though it probably needs a great deal of work. So therefore I would support this bill and hope that it gets further consideration.
Okay. Any other comment?
Just to follow up.
Any roses?
Thank you. And I agree with 90% of what you just said, Representative Dahl. And that's the part that it needs lots of discussion. And that isn't going to happen on the floor. And the reason it's not going to happen on the floor in a substantive manner is because if we don't get to delving into the different reports that have been out there that are contrary to the information that's provided to us here as to what it's called clean elections on here, but what in this bill is referred to as publicly financed campaigns, we can't have that substantive discussion. You know, it's like walking into a discussion when you've got half the information. I'm with you. I think we ought to discuss this thing considerably. That's why I have an objection to moving the bill. I think it needs to be discussed thoroughly. I wouldn't have any objection if we developed a workshop or a work session on this bill so that we could have people come in that represent both sides of the issue and have a very hearty, thorough discussion. I would love to delve in to the Goldwater report that we heard a little bit of information about. I really want to go into the General Accounting Office report that was done in 07.
Did we?
We have plenty of information here. But the problem is we can't skim over it in 5 minutes and make a rational, logical decision as to whether or not this bill should move forward. I agree. We need to discuss it. There's nothing that would make me better than to have a two-hour televised discussion on the pros and cons, because unfortunately when the initiative comes forward, all we're going to hear are sound bites.
That's right.
And if we don't have that discussion here, where is it going to be held?
That's right. That's
and we can't do it on the floor. It's impossible to do it on the floor. So that's right. The reason I think the bill shouldn't move until we've vetted it thoroughly. Whatever happens, happens.
Any other comment?
I guess I would.
Then whatever we do, I'd like to wrap it up.
That's fine. I guess I would ask if there's going to be an opportunity to do that. If there is an opportunity to do that, then I would support holding it and actually vetting it. But if there is no opportunity to have that two-hour discussion in front of the public, then I would support passing this bill.
I would, if I may, I would think that, you know, due to the lateness of the hour and the 90-day session, and we will probably not be having any more house bills of whatever variety, good or bad, you know, after this coming weekend. So for all, then we could be listening primarily to bills from the other body. And so there's probably not 2 hours available for discussion, major discussion on any controversial subject, at least at this committee level.
Mr. Chairman.
That's the fact of the matter. Representative Johnson and Representative Rose.
I want to clarify. I appreciate what Representative Rose has said about the Public Action Committee, but I don't think that this bill addresses the kind of attack that's going on against us right now. Even though we have filed, I don't know that we would be eligible for that money while we're in session. So I think that my point is that there's nothing I can do, and even once I got the money, the attack happens while I was in session, that I would be eligible for that three times. The way I read this piece of legislation, if it were happening during the campaign, that would be differently. But the kind of attack that's going on against all of us now is not covered in this, and that's the reason for my non-support. Not so much that if it happens during election, then I would be able to respond and do the things that I needed to do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, you know, I don't want to go very far, you know, in the position we have here, but it would. It seemed to me that the ad may be using the wolf hunting control issue for a broader purpose, you know, that be as it may. Representative Grunberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill goes to two more committees. It goes to Judiciary and Finance, so there'll be plenty of time to vet it.
Okay. Let's take action on the bill one way or the other. Did anybody wish to move the bill?
Oh, I'll move the bill.
Well, do so.
I move the bill.
Okay, the bill has been moved. Is there an objection?
I object.
Okay, I think there was at least one objection.
You can put me on the record.
There was three of us, actually.
Okay, is there any further discussion on the bill? This is a discussion to move or not move the bill out of committee, and it needs to be version M.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Roses.
I guess I misunderstood. I thought that moving the bill and you wanted to take a vote on it was going to stop the discussion. But if we're allowed to discuss the bill, I have lots of things I want to talk about. But in reference to my statement about a workshop, I realize we're in a 90-day session and that we're very limited on the amount of time we have in this committee. But nothing stops us from holding a special committee meeting on a Saturday or a Sunday after we come back from Easter break. We don't have all of those filled with calendars for the floor. I would be happy to head up that committee. I would be happy to get a group of people together, announce that we have a public forum where people could come in and vet the concerns over this bill and have a very thorough discussion on it. But if that is not something that you want to have happen, then let's take a vote on the bill, and I will be a no vote.
I would imagine that we may well have Saturday sessions because of the quantity of bills that would be coming from the other body. So I don't know that they really would be a reasonable opportunity to do that because we may, sorry to say, have to have special, not special, but meetings on Saturday to, you know, to do the job we need to do within the 90-day period because we have been limited. They had all the discussion we'd like to have because of a certain initiative that we had.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I also appreciate the fact of going to two other committees. You know, when I'm in a committee and another committee seen the bill before I have, my understanding is and my hope is that they did a good job of working on that bill before they sent it to me. I certainly hope they don't send it to me in fragments, hoping that I'm the one that's going to put the puzzle back together. Because that's the reason of having various people on various committees is so it gets to be viewed by more people, examined by more people, have an opportunity to be amended by more people, and put in a position in which it becomes a workable document that it's more likely to be understood and supported when it gets to the floor. So I feel like we're rushing through this, and I think we're using the 90-day session as an excuse. I feel like we want to move this on because it has some controversy connected to it. If feel like we're moving on because it's a bill that has a lot of difficulty and will garner a tremendous amount of attention and support. That's exactly why I can't move it out of this committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other comment? Can I take the roll, please?
Representative Grunberg?
Yes.
Representative Dahl?
Yes.
Representative Roses?
No.
Representative Coghill?
No.
Representative Johansson?
No.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Chair Lynn?
Yes.
3 yea, 4 nay.
Okay, with that, the bill does not move from committee. I'd like to thank everybody for some of the very thoughtful discussion. Okay, the next on the agenda is HB 266. And, Reverend Gattula, are you prepared?
I'm going to tell you, Bob.
Huh?
Is it 266?
Yeah, that's on state employee dependent child care. Centers, I guess that stands for. Did I get the right number? 266.
Is it right?
Mr. Chair, we have a proposed CS. Nancy, did we adopt this CS?
No.
Do you want it?
I might explain real briefly before we do that.
Well, do you want? Yes. Please identify yourself, and then we'll do what needs to be done here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members. My name is Beth Curtula, and I'm the representative for Downtown Juneau. And with me today is my aide, Leah Carpinetti.
Welcome.
And I'm going to be brief. We could have hundreds of people here today, but in respect of the committee's time and the 90-day session, we haven't done that. You do have a series of letters supporting the legislation, and I've tried to meet with each of you individually. But really, at the heart of this is the hope that the state can step forward in allowing departments and employees, if they find it necessary, to have space for a private contractor to come in and do child care. And it would have a huge economic and societal impact on our state, just this small step of allowing in the areas where it was found necessary to do this. So you have a CS before you. I took the liberty of getting one drafted and providing it to your staff for the simple reason that some of the members in talking with them expressed concern about competition with the private sector. That's not the intent of the bill at all. And it would just, the CS has one section in it that would clarify that the department would have to actually make a determination whether there was a lack of availability of child care sufficient to justify an approval of a center. So I think you probably would want to adopt the CS just because it does make it really abundantly clear that there's no intent to have any competition.
So I entertain a motion to adopt CS for 266 version E.
I'll move.
Okay, so move. Okay, without objection, we're working on version E. Okay.
May I inquire?
Yes, please.
Through the chair. Representative Curtula, where is the section added?
The section is on the top of page 2. It's lines 3 through 6.
Thank you.
And it just really clears it up. Thank you.
Okay. And Representative Roses.
Thank you. And Representative Curtula, I appreciate your coming by my office. I thought we had a very substantive discussion on this. And I'm very much supportive of the concept, but I do have a little bit of a concern, as I shared with you before. And the concern that I have has to do with if we allow a facility in a state building, we put it out to private contractor that's in there, and if that contractor happens to fold, the way I read the bill is this department in state that's responsible for that would then take over the operation of that center.
I'm going to turn this over to my aide, Ms. Carpinetti, because we did take that to heart. Thank you, Representative.
For the record, my name is Leah.
A little closer, please.
Okay. Through the chair, can I see this actually really quickly? Thank you. So on page, on page 3, line 3, it says, B, upon approval of the department, the sponsoring state agency may be responsible for the operation of the child care center when, and then there's 1 and 2, and if the...
Right.
And what we feel is that there's, because it's only upon the approval of the department, and it's only if the state agency wants to do that, that there's enough kind of hoops that they would have to jump through that they would really want to have to do this. It wouldn't just revert without any thought or it wouldn't, it's not automatic.
And may I follow up on that?
Yes.
Thank you.
Deputy Moses.
I appreciate that. And I did see that in the language. But the other part, in addition to that, that gives me a little bit of concern starts on page 3, line 13, where it says, neither the operator nor any personnel employed by or at a child care facility may be considered a state employee of the state unless a state agency takes over the operation of the facility. Mm. Now, there are plenty of folks that need child care. There's no question about it. Trust me, I understand child care. My daughter owns one that I financed for in Colorado, and it's very profitable, by the way. But I just don't think that the state needs to be in the position of running child care facilities, because if we open the door in one place, we're going to have it everywhere across the state. And what is the likelihood that if I'm in the department where my children are going to this child care, that I'm not going to think that this is needed? I mean, there may not be an automatic switch that turns it on, but there's also not one that keeps it closed either. And so we need great child care. We need good child care. We need a place for our children to be safe. I just don't think the state belongs in the business of doing it.
Through the chair, if I might just comment quickly
yes.
on that. I hear you and appreciate that concern, and it certainly isn't the intent that that's where we're going initially. It's truly a fail-safe. If everything else fails, if you can't find a provider, if the department goes through the hoops and makes the decision. But it certainly is a policy call for the committee if you want to allow that as a fail-safe or not. We did keep it in as an absolute last choice. Thank you.
Representative Johansson and then Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you explain how the federal, they have one down in the federal building. They have a child care in the building. Is that contracted out? Is it run by federal employees? Do they just lease the state and hire a contractor? And are they allowed to go off of federal property and lease a building somewhere or contract with a child care provider somewhere else off campus?
So, Representative Johansson through the chair. Our bill is actually modeled on the federal bill that does the same thing down at the federal building here in Juneau. It was originally contracted out to a child care organization that was based out of Fairbanks, and a few years ago the people in Fairbanks decided that they didn't want to continue. I mean, it was just geographically too spread out, so a group of parents that decided to come together, and it's now a board-run organization, but it is, so it's still an independent contractor. It's just not the private industry right now. And they are in the federal building, I believe, I'm 80% sure, the space is provided, but that's all. And in our bill, the space could be provided by the sponsoring state agency, or they could pass those costs along to the independent contractor.
Do you want to follow up?
Yeah.
In the federal program that they have set up, is there any, as Representative Roses was talking about, is there any, I guess, provision or way that somehow federal employees would end up running or being part of the program?
Representative Johansson through the chair, I don't know the answer to that question, but I can definitely find it out and let you know.
And if I could follow up again, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
And I guess, again, following along the lines, is there any way that the federal government ends up, I guess, on the hook for either services or facilities or anything like that? Is there...
Representative Johansson through the chair. I mean, the rent and I think maintenance and utilities costs are paid by, actually what happens is all of the different, because in the federal building, sorry, there's a bunch of different federal agencies that are all in the same building, they all contribute to those costs. All of those individual agencies come together and pay the rent, utilities, and maintenance, but that's the only cost right now that they take on. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, if I may, I guess I'm getting back to page 3, line 14 and 15. It says, as Representative Rose has pointed out, child care considered to be employees of the state unless a state agency operates the facility under AS 3990. I guess what I'm asking is there, and I think you answered it, the federal government does not operate the facility, but it's a contract.
Through the chair, I think that's right here, but I do want to point out that there are federally operated child care centers. I mean, the military would be the one that we've read about the most. So not here, but certainly in other arenas, the federal government has made that recognition and does federally operate child care centers. And
I would also like to add, they, in just like in our bill, I'm sorry if I misstated this earlier, they can, and the federal government does operate even just not only in the military, but in places like it could be here in Juneau, they could operate it themselves. But they don't here, but they can.
Thank you. I had a comment, but I'll wait for committee discussion. Thank you.
Okay, Reverend Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I commend to the legislators on the committee the June 19, 2007 legislative research report. It contains a lot of information on this. And it looks like the trend in other states is to provide this kind of care, is it not? Through the chair?
Through the chair. Some states have done this, yes.
Almost half the states, right? At least 22 states. And how about large businesses of the size of the state of Alaska in comparison with the rest of the economy? If the state is one of the biggest employers in the state, is it not? And how about other private individual, I mean, private companies? What is the trend there? How many private companies provide this kind of service?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, I don't know the actual numbers about how many private large employers provide this service, although I do know that it's more and more employers are starting to do that. You start to see, we have a number of studies that from these different employers that have on-site childcare that show the benefits of it. So although I don't know the numbers, I know that the trend is more and more people are starting to do this. And the reason that is because more and more households have all of available parents in the workforce. So more and more employees have childcare needs, a lot more than they used to.
May I continue, please?
Governor Grunberg.
And those that don't often allow the parents to telecommute and work from home, right?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, yes, I mean, that is, more and more companies are working on what they call family, like pro-family options or work-life options, which, and there's telecommuting, there's on-site childcare, there's some facility, or some employers will kind of buy slots in childcare facilities that are near them for when children have sick days, stuff like that. So there's different options that people are pursuing.
Do you know if the state provides that kind of alternative working arrangement that would alleviate the need for child care? We don't have that kind of an option here, do we?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, I don't believe the state buys any child care slots or.
Do you know if other states do provide that kind of alternative working arrangement for parents of small children?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, I know that more and more states are looking into options like that. I don't know exactly how many or, you know, yeah. So I guess I would have to look into that more and get back to you.
Because that certainly makes it much easier and more user-friendly for the parents of small children to work. I know because my son and daughter-in-law, particularly my daughter-in-law, she works for Wells Fargo and has that option. And it's a real difficult situation if a parent can't either get child care or telecommute or have a flexible work schedule with both spouses helping with the child care. Do you know in these states that run facilities, do they arrange the cost so that it's affordable for the workers? How competitive is it from you know, not the private sector's point of view, but with the workers so that it enables the workers to participate in the workforce? Do you know what kind of a financial arrangement they have like that? Through the chair.
Yeah, you can't do the chair at the beginning, if you would, rather than at the end.
Do you want me to repeat the question?
Definitely not.
I didn't think so. Please answer.
I'm sorry, Representative Grunberg, through the chair. Are you asking about in Alaska specifically or in the rest of the...
I'm wondering, from a cost point of view, how affordable these programs are in these other states that do offer child care. Is this affordable for the workers?
Through the chair, I know California provides a sliding scale, so my assumption is that they're probably doing what we're trying to do here. Thank you. And Florida does as well.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My concern is, and I see we have someone representing unions in the building, in the office, or in the audience. So what I'm, my question is, if we go down the road and the state provides, let's say, in the SOB building, a child care facility, is there anything in our union contracts that would require us, now that some employees have it, that we would have to provide that in every state facility?
Through the chair, I have no idea. And if that were the case, that would be a completely separate issue from this. This was inserted into the bill solely as the complete last option so that there was some stopgap. If the committee thinks it's inappropriate to start at this point with that, we can take it out of the bill and talk about it more. But it was really for the areas where we know there aren't any child care providers at this point. So... Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative.
I appreciate that, and I know sometimes collective bargaining agreements can have all kinds of fairness issues in them, and if one group gets it, everyone gets it. And I don't want to get in a situation where one department decides all of a sudden we think it's a good idea, and then all of a sudden we end up with state-funded child care. So I would like it on the record in some form or fashion that that is not the case, and I do see a representative from, I believe it's PSEA, in the audience. And with your permission, Mr. Chairman, I would like to bring Mr. Putnam up to have him put on the record that, in fact, that would not be the case in collective bargaining.
And I would think, Representative Johnson, that maybe some amendment could be put in there to address this specific issue. So, yes, we all have Mr. Putnam.
But I'd like to
speak to the issue.
If I might. I wouldn't think that the committee would want to preclude that in the future. I mean, I believe that people should have child care throughout the state agencies. So it certainly isn't my intent to delve into collective bargaining or what happens, and, of course, I'd want to understand it. But I would think that the committee would be interested in being able to assure good child care for everyone across the state in one form or another.
Mr. Chairman, if I might respond to that, I am interested in this, and I do support the bill. What I want to make sure is that we all of a sudden don't have a statewide, state-funded child care provision unknowingly for every state employee that would all of a sudden exclude the private sector and enter into that. So I support the concept, but I just want to make sure we don't go down the road that we have to end up with a child care facility in every building for every state employee.
Right. Mr. Putnam, welcome to our committee.
Yeah, I can just do it from right here. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Fate Putman for Alaska State Employees Association. There is nothing in our collective bargaining agreement now that deals with child care facilities in state facilities, and I would consider it to be probably a permissive subject of collective bargaining. It may be something that in the future we would want to do, but our intent would be, of course, that everybody be able to have child care services in their facilities. It wouldn't be something that that we would prohibit anybody else from doing. You'd love to see it for everybody, but right now it's not in collective bargaining. That answers your question.
Thank you, Representative Johnson.
Thank you. And so there is nothing in collective bargaining that could be interpreted as equal treatment for all employees. If you get something one place, you get it another. I mean, let's take child care off the table. Is there anything that says that if you get a certain number of breaks in your particular employee here, you'd get the certain. So is there anything that spreads equity over treatment across a collective bargaining unit that says one group can be treated differently within the same bargaining unit?
Well, I think that's the idea of collective bargaining, that everybody's treated the same, if that's what you're, where you're going with that. Fate Pumpkin again through the chair. I'm not quite following what you're asking, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you answered the question.
Okay. Yeah.
When you said it was equal across the board, I think you kind of told me that it could be an issue. And with that, I certainly want to either find some way to take out the state ever taking over one, or I support the concept in the bill, but I don't want to go down the road that the state gets in the child care business every day, every building, for every employee. So,
you're going to open Pandora's box here.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's exactly what I don't want to do.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Would you, while we're having other discussion on the bill, would you maybe grab some kind of a conceptual of Pandora box, a conceptual amendment?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Representative Dahl?
You know, I don't see that as such a bad idea, actually. I'd be happy to open up that Pandora box. I would love to see the state take leadership. And frankly, I'm not suggesting that we take it on right at the moment. But if it does happen to revert back, in this case, which we were talking about, I see this as a nice backup. I mean, so that people aren't left with nothing, and the kids are just walking around and have to close the doors. But on the alternative thing, if the state does take that, I think it's a good idea. Child care is a huge economic issue these days. It used to be one of those things that, oh, moms, you know, they should be staying home with the kids anyway, and so why do we care? It's not that way anymore. Now it is an enormous economic impact issue. And there are many implications for this thing, and it can be done on a very elementary level, or it can be done on a very sophisticated level with new innovations, which are going across the country. It can be a very exciting thing. And I, for one, would not shrink from this. And so I would hope that we could offer child care to all our state employees.
I don't want to expand this bill where it becomes, you know, a fairly simple bill, and all of a sudden we're addressing all child care issues in the state of Alaska. That, you know, then it becomes an entirely different bill.
Mr. Chairman, on that point.
I think we have been able to add a comment, and I'll come around. Did you want to respond to that? Who was next? Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I could maybe ask either the sponsor of the bill or Mr. Putman. If an employer offers child care, how much does that increase that employer's competitiveness in attracting and keeping good employees?
Well, through the chair, I would think it increases it quite a bit from the amount of people who have contacted our office about the problems, and I know that there's research to back that up.
Thank you.
Reverend Johnson, did you?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the point that Representative from the Valley and Juneau made, there's a very clear delineation, I think, and it's spelled out very clearly that some of us want to control the growth of government and some of us don't. This would probably be one of the areas where I would want to say that it would be okay. However, I am not a big proponent of growing government when the private sector can do it. And I'm not prepared to make the leap that the state should be everything to every person. I certainly think that the private sector should have an opportunity at this, and I see us going down a road of where we begin to put Juneau child care facilities out of business because the state's doing it, and I would certainly hate to see that happen.
Representative Johansson, and then Representative Dahl, and then Representative Rogers, if I keep that straight.
I'll help you.
Okay, I bet you will.
Thank you. I support the concept for the obvious reasons of having your kids close to your work. I think that is it's good for employees. It is good for morale. It makes it a much more acceptable and attractive job if you can have your kids right there. But I do have a bit of a concern about the language in there that connects the state running or the state being on the hook for any reason If simply we are providing space and contracting it out to private folks, I have no problem whatsoever with that. Because it makes the job, when you're advertising for jobs, I know that one of the recruitment problems that the state people and the unions always talk about is we have recruitment problems. And if you have a kid and you work, you're going to get child care. I have three kids in child care. Obviously, it's extremely expensive. It's difficult. But, if I could have my kids next door, if they lived in Juneau, it would make my job that much nicer. I could walk right next door. In the federal building, I'm sure people love to hop in the elevator and go downstairs and say hi to their kids. But the language in there that ties the state into it, and I'm not clear on how that would tie into collective bargaining or whatever like that, but those are my concerns. So when you go back and look at maybe CS or the amendments that Representative Johnson is apparently going to be working on, I'd like folks to keep that into consideration. That's kind of my perspective on the bill. The concept is good, but I don't want to get hooked into having a state-run daycare center with state employees and all that stuff. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And I share most of your comments there. Representative Ruhlberger, I believe,
Dahl.
Representative Dahl.
Thank you. I want to stay on track, too. And I think this is an important bill. It needs to be passed. And if we need to make some kind of an adjustment on this, and Representative Johnson has volunteered to do it. But I want to keep this on track and not move into the larger issues. But definitely we need the child care, and we don't have enough of it in Juneau, actually. So please, I would support this bill.
Yeah. Did you have a response?
Yeah, my response is this. The effort at a state agency running it was for the areas where there's absolutely no other choice. If the committee wants to start out with saying we're not going to allow the state to do that, I guess my qualm is you're going to find areas where there's no one available, and I don't know that someone's going to pop up out of nowhere to do it. But if that's the committee's wish to start out, it looks to me like the sections that you would take out, and we could do it conceptually, but I think probably between Representatives Johnson and Roses, they probably have the sections, but it looks like it's page 3 in lines 3 through 8, and then again lines on line 13 through the end of 15, that those are the sections you'd want to remove as a start where you would allow the state to contract. You wouldn't allow the fail-safe of the state to take it over, and that's certainly a beginning to it. And frankly, if it all came to fruition, we could see where the areas are where we just can't find anyone and come back and say, now here's the next step on the situation. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Grunberg, and then Representative.
Me.
You're next? Okay. Representative Roses.
I told you I'd remind you. Thank you. I feel a little more comfortable with that section, and I do have the amendment written down, just as you said. The I'm going to stipulate to the fact that this does all of the things that have been mentioned in terms of the positive. It puts kids close to the employees. It's going to make the employees happier. It's going to help attract and retain employees. But, the private sector has the same problem. Mm-hmm. And, the folks out in the private sector are going to take a look at this bill and say, now, one more thing that the state's responsible for or the state's involved in. So we've got to make sure that people understand that this is not picked up by the state. They're providing the space. And I can tell you that in running the daycare center that my daughter has, the biggest issue is the space and the utilities and all the other things that are necessary to come in compliance with state law. It's not the ability for her to run the daycare center or the ability to have an employee to run the daycare center. That was the easy part. The facility is what's hard. And so if you don't have the facility that qualifies, then you have to go out and find one or build one. And so, trust me, I know how expensive that is. Believe me. Now, but I think we need to be mindful of the fact that daycare is an issue for everybody, not just state employees. And so this is just one way to help. And so with that being said, I would like to offer conceptual amendment number one.
Conceptual amendment number one. And would you speak to that? Or give us your conceptual amendment?
Yes, conceptual amendment number one would be on page 3, starting with line 3, going through line 8, and delete that language. And on line 13, starting with neither the operator nor continuing through to the end of line 15, remove that language, and that is the amendment. And the intent is to remove the fail-safe for the state taking over the operation. I still think that this becomes a very valuable asset for state employees. It allows the people that participate in the process to fund it. But they are subsidized in essence because the building is going to be provided by the state, which is a huge benefit. So that's the amendment.
And
that's
is there any objection to amendment number one?
Yes.
Okay. Objection to Representative Gruenberg. Speak to your objection, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We are having a great deal of difficulty now with the new pension system or lack of a pension in keeping and attracting and keeping state employees. Young people are not coming in. We're losing people. And this is something we can do to attract and keep young people. Many people come to work for the state before they have children. And if we don't make it so that they can stay with the state when they have young children, they'll leave for that reason, something totally unrelated to the pension issue. And this is something we can do to reverse that trend. And as the sponsor of the bill said, this is a fail-safe kind of a thing, and it will help in a circumstance where they need to help when there's no other facility available. This would be the only facility available, and if we don't provide this, these people will leave the state. Number two, it will cut against people in certain parts of the state. In Anchorage, Juneau, and Fairbanks, there's lots, relatively, of private daycare. But how about Homer, Nanilchik, North Pole, I think that in vain, out in the bush. I mean, you know, we have a problem in maintaining the economy throughout the state, particularly in the rural areas. And I look at this bill as a start of trying to keep people and get them to have some kind of an economy throughout the state. And I would encourage that we provide alternative methods of people working for the state, telecommuting, things like that, so that we can have people working throughout this state, which is one-fifth the size of the country. And we're not just in a state of several urban areas. We are a state that's mainly rural. And this amendment will really work against people in the rural areas of the state. It's unfair to the little communities. And so those are the reasons I oppose the amendment.
Any other comment on the amendment only from the committee? Representative Rogers, and I ask the sponsor the bill to give her a take on it. Representative Rogers?
Thank you. Just to follow up on Representative Gruenberg's statement, I think this bill, even with this amendment, still helps to attract and retain employees because the proportional cost for child care is going to be considerably less in a state-owned facility where you're not having to pay for a building or pay for lease for the space or the utilities to operate it. It's going to be extremely beneficial in the bush where utility costs are exorbitant. I can assure you that this is going to certainly serve everybody across the state equally as well, because if you're going to have to create your own child care facility where you're paying for the lease space and all the utilities and everything else goes with it, it doesn't become profitable, or else you're charging such an exorbitant amount to cover the cost. That's why child care centers aren't there. If you provide the space and if you provide the utilities, you know, it's like the old thing, you build it and they will come. I can assure you it will happen because the price will be unbelievably modified.
Okay. Any comment from the sponsor?
You know, this is the first committee of referral, Mr. Chairman, and I really appreciate the time and energy you put into it with the 90 days. We went back and forth about this. We put the fail-safe in and wanted the committee's, you know, thinking on it. I tend to think that Representative Roses is correct, that if you allow the space, there is a provision where the state could you know, not pass on the costs. And I think maybe if we're lucky in those very rural areas that we know have terrible trouble, that maybe that would entice someone to start their own business and come in. So as a first step, as a beginning, I'm not sure it's a bad idea to start small. We started out with the huge bill 4 years ago, and we've come down to this. So as a first step in the first committee, and we can certainly do a little more research and see, you know, how people feel about it, I don't think it's a bad thing. And frankly, I'd rather see the bill have a little bit of movement today rather than demand that we use our ID on a fail-safe and not allow it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, and then are you going to remove your objection or maintain it? Either way, make your comment, but let's move on.
I'm going to remove my objection.
Okay.
Thank you.
You move the objection. Good. I always cautious here.
With that introduction, how can I not?
You might find a way. I don't know. Okay, your objection has been removed. Amendment number one has passed the committee without objection. Are there any Representative Dahl?
Just have a quick question. In the federal building, are the costs of child care there substantially less? So there is a substantial savings there or not?
Representative Dahl, through the chair, they work on a sliding scale as well, I believe, and so it depends on what, you know, your income is. But because the lease and the rent and the utilities is paid for, it's it is less expensive. They do have a large waiting list, though, so I don't.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. I don't have a clue what child care costs. I have six children. Well, my oldest is 54 and my youngest is 35.
I will give you a hint. It starts at around $215 a week per child.
Per child, yeah.
Well, I would have been more destitute than I am now with six children.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Johansson.
I can tell you the going rate in Ketchikan is $1,500 a month for my three kids. It's expensive.
Well, fortunately, I may not have any more children.
It's reduced the more kids you have.
Yeah. Cheaper by the dozen.
Cheaper by the dozen.
Okay. Any other comment? If not, I'll entertain a motion to move the bill.
Mr. Chairman, if I could.
Yeah. Oh, I forgot. Go ahead, Representative.
My amendment was handled, but Mr. Chairman, I wanted to say that I would probably the amendment makes me very, very, very supportive. I was very supportive before. I think that this bill is needed. I think that in areas like Representative Gruenberg said that this will allow, I think there's a provision here prior discussion. I just want to make sure that if it's not full, that the private sector would have an opportunity, but state employees would have first shot at it. So I think this provides an opportunity for employment, not just state, but in the private sector as well, when you can find child care. It is a big problem, and I'm very appreciative of Representative Curtula bringing this forward, and I'm now very, very supportive. I'll make sure I get two.
Would you care to move the bill?
Oh, absolutely. Mr. Chairman, with that, I will move the CS for House Bill 266 as amended with zero, if any, fiscal notes, version E, with individual recommendations.
Are there any objection? If not, CS for House Bill.
As amended, right?
As amended. He said it. Tuesday, moves on committee, and thank you for bringing this bill for us.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. I truly do. Thanks.
Thank you. And we have one more bill on the schedule here, which is HB 366. And then I want to get a short report from our chair of the subcommittee before we adjourn. Good morning, Representative Crawford.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Please introduce your bill.
Terry Crawford, and this is my intern this year, Chris Birdsall. He's done the major amount of work on this bill. What this bill does is it corrects, I believe, a mistake that we made a few years back when what we did was we, for multiple misdemeanors and felons, we took their PFD away. That was what we intended to do, and we did that. But we also, in doing that, we took it away from their innocent children and from the parent that has the custody. I don't think that was the intention of anybody in the legislature. What I believed at the time was that the kids that were in the custody of the other parent, that there was an order that made me put them at first the list. But actually, the EFD goes to the Department of Corrections, and I don't think any of us intended to punish those innocent children. So, what this does is it makes a grant from the Department of Revenue to those children to make up for the PFD that we have taken and given to the Department of Corrections. Simple concept, just a kind of a not so simple way to correct the problem.
Nothing is simple around this place. Any questions from the committee? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand that, and I don't know that we have anyone from the Department of Corrections, but at one point the Department of Corrections was actually applying for the dividends for the individuals because they figured, I'm not going to get it, why apply? So they weren't going into the mix. So is there any provision that if an inmate decides not to apply and not fill out the paperwork, I've got a 10 to 15 year sentence, why do I care who gets it? Is there any provision in here that would require the department to fill out this so it could get to the minor child?
To my understanding, this doesn't apply to the people that are eligible to receive the PFD. This applies to the people that are ineligible to receive the PFD. We made them ineligible because of being a felon or multiple misdemeanors, and they're not able to apply. So what we're doing here is making a grant from Department of Revenue to make up for that money that goes to the Department of Corrections.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But my understanding was that the Department of Corrections actually had to fill out a form to get that money and almost apply on behalf of the inmate, and so that they would, and there had to be an application process there. And I'm drawing from memory, and that's sometimes dangerous.
No.
So I thought what the department did was fill out a form and send in an application, which basically became a proxy for that dividend, and then they received the money. It wasn't an automatic transfer depending on the resident being incarcerated. So I'm wondering what mechanism is there. I support the concept. I just want to make sure the mechanism is there to make sure that we're not, the department still doesn't fill out that paperwork, so there's communications between the department so they know we're not doing two, giving it to the department and a grant to someone else. And I don't know how to get that there without someone from the department here.
Mr. Chairman.
Somebody from the department is here.
Oh, pardon me? Maybe there's someone from Department of Corrections.
Is somebody here?
I think
no,
it's revenue.
She's getting up.
No, she's from revenue, I think.
Oh, no.
And I don't know where Jerry Burnett went either.
He was here earlier. I don't know.
I know it was. But,
is there anyone online, Mr.
I don't. I have Jerry Barnett. No, he's not online for questions only. I don't.
Ms. Richter,
you're here.
A division, and
please join us.
If I could say, I don't believe that we're dealing with people that are eligible. This bill only deals with people that are ineligible because they are a multiple misdemeanor or they have felony. They're not able to even apply.
Governor Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My understanding is the Department of Corrections got their permanent fund. And there's some mechanism to get that to them. There's a form or something. And maybe I'm remembering wrong. So if you could.
Please identify yourself and weigh in on this.
My name is Debbie Richter. I'm the director with the Permanent Fund Dividend Division. And I can attest to the process.
Okay.
Basically, right now with incarcerated individuals, some apply and some don't. If they do apply, they are denied, and that's based on a match that the PFD division does with the Department of Corrections. And that's the extent of our interaction with the incarcerated individual. They apply, we deny them, and there's a calculation that's made that we pay the Department of Corrections based on. And it's not an actual head count of those people. It's a calculation.
Reverend Johnson.
Thank you. So I would assume you would apply the same calculation or a similar calculation to get the money to the appropriate people in this legislation, so there wouldn't be any real interaction or any crossing of paperwork or anything. You just say there are 28 people, and that's who they get the check, and it would go to them, and it would kind of be the same process? Is that
is correct. It has been explained to me that it would be a calculation as well.
And so how would you know? I mean, it's a calculation, and that's a number on a page. How would you know where to get that check? How would there be what kind of application or follow-up would there be to find out that Fred's son has got an order and he needs to get that check? How would that process actually work?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, I am not sure exactly how that would work. I was assured by Jerry Burnett of the Department of Revenue that that would be something that occurred between Child Support and Department of Corrections.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That works for me.
Very good. And Representative Rosas.
Thank you. I don't know if this is a question for you or not. I mean, if you can answer it, fine. If you can't, I appreciate the fact that we may be delving outside of your area. So I support the bill, and I support the concept, but really what this does is it limits only those children whose parent is incarcerated that is due child support. It does nothing for those children whose parents are incarcerated that aren't receiving child support, and I would venture to guess that they probably need the money just as badly as those that are under a child support provision. So I guess the question I would have for you would be, if this were to pass, would it be the responsibility of the Permanent Fund Board, in you in particular, to determine who the money gets funneled to, or does the money go as a lump sum to another entity and they distribute it? So I guess it kind of goes back to the same question Johnson asked, so I guess you already answered my question. But
Mr. Chairman.
It's cumbersome.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Johansson.
I'm trying to get to the point that the sponsor was talking about, and he mentioned that, I guess, and it's in the bill, these are people that are ineligible to apply. Now, are there, and this may be for corrections, and I wish corrections were here, but are there people incarcerated who are both eligible and ineligible to receive a dividend check?
Representative Johansson, through the chair, I am not sure I quite understand the question. Anyone can apply for a dividend. The application will either be approved or denied, and for incarcerated individuals, they will be denied.
Follow up.
Representative Johansson.
So basically, it's anybody and their mother can apply, and you just deny and send it on, and corrections or CSED or whoever else sorts out the detail.
No, through the chair. The match is made with our databases, and based on that information, when an application comes in, the application is determined based on the information provided. The denial is based on the information provided from the Department of Corrections.
Okay. Representative Dahl?
Why do they apply if they know it's going to be denied?
Because they're hoping.
Hope. Through the chair, Representative Dahl, I wish I knew the answer to that.
Well, maybe I have the answer. If they were smart, they wouldn't be incarcerated to begin with.
That's not true.
Well, you know, I'm just sort of curious about this. I know that looking at the budget of Department of Corrections this year, they had a substantial increase because they're garnering more of the permanent fund. And I saw quite a bit of that in there. But you say it's a formula. They don't just get the straight amount. They get a certain they get a percentage.
Through the chair, Representative Dahl, that is correct, and it is not based on actual eligible people who are incarcerated. It is based on the number of people incarcerated.
Okay. Yes. We've been joined by Jerry Burnett. Please identify yourself.
The Department of Revenue. As Debbie has said, the calculation is based on the prior year number of people who were incarcerated, not whether they're eligible or not. There's no predetermination of eligibility. And then the distribution between corrections and the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault is done in the budget process and has nothing to do with the number of people incarcerated. It's amount based on the amount of money, not based on the amount.
Boy, that isn't peculiar, I have to say. You have to sort that one out. Sounds like bureaucracy to me. What would be the, I suppose it would be quite a consequence by taking, if this bill passes, we have 5,000 Alaska children, there could be quite a consequence in terms of the distribution of monies.
To the chair, Representative Dahl, the distribution of money would be dealt with in the budget process next year. I would guess that we'll have a few more people incarcerated this year. There were, the formula said 10,188 people in for the 07 dividend. It will probably be more than that. I'm guessing more people are incarcerated. The dividend this year will be some amount, which, based on current projections, will be more than the 07. So I'm thinking we're dealing with an amount of money here that's totaling somewhere near $20 million. The distribution, if these people were eligible and we were garnishing them for child support, we could be potentially garnishing up to $10 million from those individuals had they been eligible for dividends and were able to apply.
You said 10,000?
There's 10,000, just over 10,000 people who are determined by formula not to be eligible, who are not eligible, but we don't know if they would have been eligible if they weren't incarcerated. So the numbers here that we're dealing with the size of the dividend for this year, because this will be effective next year since all the money is appropriated in the FY09 budget already. We're talking about using this
have a question. I understand there's 5,500 people in the prison systems, and so when you say there's 10,000 people, I'm wondering where these people are.
You know, I can't tell you exactly where, to the chair, Representative Dahl, but I used to be the administrative director at the Department of Corrections. And I can tell you that there are a number of people who are incarcerated for short periods of time during any year or were incarcerated previous years. The average sentence length is not multiple years on the people who are in the prison system. So you can easily run numbers up to as many as 40,000 people who may be in and out of prisons in a year. So it's not the number at a count at any time is not representative of the number of people who are in and out of the prison system.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Coggio.
Okay, this will be for Jerry or the sponsor. What I understand is that these are the exceptions, and the exception here is that you're going to develop regulations that will allow granting, and my expectation is it would be the grant equivalent to a dividend. Question number one.
The chair, from the legislation, it's not clear that that would be the case. That could be the case.
We need to make that clear before we go on further.
Agreed.
And the next question is, how do you find the minor child of an incarcerated individual?
To the chair, Representative Coghill, the Department of Revenue Child Support Services Division has a case on almost every child who is subject to child support in Alaska.
Okay.
And we have identified approximately 5,000 people who meet 5,000 of the 10,000 here.
And I guess the question then from Mr. Burdette then is, would it be the expectation that that would be an automatic grant or that there would be an application process to that?
To the chair, Representative Coghill, we haven't really spent a lot of time on how this would work, but since we have a case, we have known amounts of money going to the children, known amounts of debt from the parents, and there's a couple of points I'd like to make. One, that this does not offset the debt of the incarcerated parent in any way. So we, you know, it would be a fairly simple process to do this.
Mr. Chairman, if I might ask the sponsor what his intention is, and that might help the Department of Revenue. Representative, would it be your intention that this grant would be equivalent to a dividend, or would it be in place of a designated child support amount?
This would be to replace the amount of the dividend.
Okay.
And that was my intent.
Okay. And then the okay, I think that'll help.
And then I had a question. If we're children getting child support, how about those who do not get child support for some reason? Any provision for these? I mean, if they get child support, I mean, at the elderly, they may not. A lot of people, kids are supposed to get child support, but they don't.
Representative Lynn, I'm not sure how anyone would be able to administer a program for those children
either,
because we wouldn't know of them. And, you know, unless they applied, and if they did apply, then they would be eligible for child support and could establish a case with an incarcerated parent. There would be for an incarcerated parent, anyone who's incarcerated, there's an automatic minimum child support due from them on a monthly basis of $50 for a child.
Okay, that's Reverend Cogger, are you going to propose an amendment?
No, I just wanted to get it on the record because I think that what we've done is given broad authority for regulation, and I think either we specify it in the bill or we get the public testimony on the issue. And so I'm satisfied with it. The intention is to have it the amount of the dividend of that year, and so I'm satisfied.
If I could just make one comment on that, to the chair, to Representative Coghill, and the understanding that what we would do if this bill were to pass is we would develop some kind of a program, regulations with that amount, and then during the budget process for the FY10 budget, we would go to OMB and propose that the money be split so that that much money goes to the child support grant program, that the rest goes to corrections and Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Thank you. Representative Roses.
Thank you. My children were fortunate enough that they were born at a time when they received a permanent fund dividend check every year of their life.
Mm-hmm.
And thanks, because they paid for college. Would there be a way in which a child whose parent had been incarcerated or a guardian of a child whose parent had been incarcerated could apply for the dividend on that individual's behalf? Because as an adult, I applied on behalf of my children. Could a child apply on behalf of an adult?
To the chair, Representative Roses, since the parent who's incarcerated is not eligible for a dividend, you wouldn't be able to apply for that adult's dividend, even if there was statutory authority to do so, and currently there isn't any.
Okay, thank you. May I follow up?
Follow up.
My concern is it's easy to identify those who are listed in the records as receiving child support, but it wouldn't necessarily be that easy to find those that aren't receiving child support. That's why I asked the question, because if I had a disabled parent, am I allowed to apply for a dividend on behalf of that disabled parent that can't apply for themselves?
To the chair, Representative Roses, yes, you would be able to apply, or a sponsor or guardian would be able to apply for disabled. The difference here is that statutorily these people are not
right.
eligible for dividends.
But this would allow them to be. It would allow the child to be eligible for what would have been theirs had they been eligible, correct?
Well, to the chair, Representative Roses, this method is it goes around the statute in a sense and allows that child to become, to receive that money, which if their parent were not incarcerated and were eligible, we would be garnishing. We garnish 100% of dividends for people who have child support arrearages. There is no limitation on our garnishment.
President Coghill.
It's my understanding then that for an incarcerated parent, this could be in lieu of child support. But it is still true, if I understand correctly, that if they're with a custodial parent, that they could still apply on the behalf of that child for that dividend, in which case they would get the dividend.
So, the Chair, Representative Coghill, the child would still get their dividend. And in the event that a child does not get a dividend prior to the time they're 18 because no one applies on their behalf, they have 2 years after their 18th birthday. We changed the regulation this past year. It used to be 1 year after their 18th birthday so that they can apply for all their past dividends. And we reserve money in the dividend calculation each year for children based on an estimate so that there's always money.
I just wanted to be very clear that this is not replacing a dividend, but in lieu of child support, equivalent to a dividend.
That's essentially correct, although it does not relieve the non-custodial parent who is incarcerated of any of their responsibilities.
So, in other words, they get the dividend or the equivalent of the dividend, but also still be responsible for child support. Am I correct? Very good. Any other? We're running out of time here.
Yeah.
What's the pleasure of the committee? Is anybody online for this bill? I have Tam Cook online for questions, and Jerry Burnett is here. Anybody in the audience on this bill? If not, I'm closed public testimony. What's the pleasure of the committee?
Chairman, I'll go ahead and move the bill, the version C of House Bill 366 with individual recommendations and attach fiscal notes.
Okay. Any objection?
Where does the bill go next?
That bill goes to finance.
No objection.
Okay. Thank you very much for moving this bill. Representative Johansson, you were appointed to get to a subcommittee. Could you tell us what that subcommittee was, what their mission was, and where you are in the process?
We were given three resolutions and one bill on conflict of interest, and we had a hearing on Monday.
And what, for the record, what conflict of interest are we talking about?
I don't have the bill numbers in front of me.
Well, it's without on the record. Bill numbers.
We had three resolutions and one bill sent to the subcommittee. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but like I said, it's on
and
the
those,
record.
Folks who on the House floor, for example, want to vote for a bill and they declare a conflict of interest for whatever reason, and then they typically somebody objects, and then typically the chair says you'll be required to vote. Am I correct?
That's correct, sir. It has to do with conflicts of interest on floor votes, and we have the sponsors of each legislation come up and explain what their bill was and what their intent behind introducing the legislation was. We had a good conversation. Representative Gruenberg, Representative Johnson, and myself sit on the committee. And the conversations pretty much mirrored the conversations in committee that called for a subcommittee to be appointed. There was a lot of confusion. There was no real point where everybody agreed that any of the bills were perfect, and we, in our conversations, struggled to find common ground between any of the four proposals. Representative Gruenberg's staff is putting together a side-by-side and trying to delve into the issues a little bit more, so we're right basically in the middle of trying to find common ground.
Any questions for Representative Johansson? And so, again, I may miss it because I was signing the paper for the last bill. Do you have a recommendation for the full committee?
We do not at this time.
Okay. Do you anticipate that meeting again?
Depending on schedules in this after Easter, extremely busy time of the year, we'll have to see if we're going to be able to find
okay.
time.
And then at maybe the next committee meeting, could you tell us what you may or may not do, depending on the situation then? Okay. Is any other business to come before the committee? I want to ask my chief of staff, Nancy, do you have the proposed schedule for our next meeting? Okay, we will not be meeting Tuesday. Our next scheduled meeting is going to be Thursday. For that, thank you to the committee and those who testified in the audience. The House chair.